last part of the first handout, which is page 24 in the book. So there's these little guided meditations in highlighted in gray. And I thought maybe we could just start with that as a meditation practice, actual contemplation. So why don't we, Helen can start by reading this paragraph. Do you have this one? Yeah.
Stop for a moment and look at the world around you. Sense that everything you objectify is thought created. Everything is mind-made and has no reality outside of what thought says it is. Now look within and see that everything you think you are, all of your ideas, images, limitations, and self-conclusions, is formed from memory. What thought has led you to believe? What would the world look like if you were quietly present without the intrusion of and belief in your memory?
Let's try just for a minute, just contemplate what the world would look like without intrusion of and belief in your memory, which just means not activating your memory of the past, just being totally present. So, what does the world look like in such a case? Any ways you could report on this world?
Gentle.
Yeah, gentle. It's a gentle world. Nothing seems to be so intrusive and forcing itself on us in the same way. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
It feels
vast. Vast. Mm-hmm. Less limited. Yeah. Yes.
Sometimes it feels vast, but right now I feel more the emptiness.
Mm-hmm. And like emptiness meaning?
It's nothing, that's this empty space, but not in a negative way. A full emptiness.
Meaning maybe no particular pieces are reaching out for their particular attention.
Yeah, quiet.
So I think we all have this experience sometimes in zazen. I think it's a nice description of how both sides here in this meditation instruction, everything we objectify, and I think this means, I think he's talking about the external world of objects like colors and sounds and shapes and complex things like Zen centers and towns and all these things that we externally objectify is thought created, right? It's things don't come in these, packaged in these thoughts or concepts until we package them that way. So in that way, everything that we're experiencing externally is mind-made, has no reality outside of what thought says it is a nice description, a radical description, right, of how the world is, as we normally experience it, is a thought version of it. And then looking within, we say, this is kind of looking outward is kind of conceptually constructed, but then when we look within ourselves, everything we think we are, our ideas, images, limitations, and self-conclusions are also conceptually constructed from thoughts, and particularly here he's emphasizing from memory, our past ideas about ourselves. So, small, you know, description of being in the present moment, but huge implications, right? That everything we perceive and experience externally and internally is conceptually created or thought created. Yes.
So my experience, the one it seems like he's pointing at, is that the emptiness in forms. And that's like the car drove by and it just evaporates.
Yeah.
It's not really real.
Yeah. I noticed that too when we were sitting, that the car drove by and the instruction was, how do we perceive the world without bringing up our memories? And I'm like, well, immediately a memory comes up of like, that's the sound of a car. Because I remember what cars sound like. So I can see that like, that automatic memory is already like limiting that experience. And I think that's natural. Of course, it's not about stopping our memory, but, less investment in our memory. And knowing that that's the sound of a car, that's a great limitation on the direct experience of that sound based on memory. Yes.
Vibrantly changing.
That's the experience of the world.
Yeah.
Vibrantly changing. Yeah. And hard to even say exactly what it is that's changing. When we come really into the present in that way, there's what we usually call sights and sounds and all kinds of experiences, but without naming and conceiving them in our usual way, it's just like a flow of vibrant change. Less and less nameable. So I think that's a nice meditation and a very humbling statement here that see that everything you objectify, and I think objectify means actually experience as objects, is thought created externally and internally. So this is just, you know, at the beginning of the book here, but these are big statements.
He starts with a bang.
He starts with a bang, for sure.
Quickly.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
Oh God.
Yeah.
He's not wasting any time.
That's true. And in a way, the rest keeps just going in this direction, but it gets more, more particular investigations of different things. So this chapter was called, In Search of the Essence. So looking for some essence and things. And now we move to chapter 2, which is called Consensus, Paradigm, and Abstract Thought. And as was mentioned in the first chapter, the author, Rodney Smith, uses this term, the consensus paradigm. In Buddhism, we often talk about conventional truth as basically a synonym. Consensus meaning like, what the world generally agrees upon. The world has come together very informally as a kind of convention that we call a human world. And this convention has consciously and unconsciously decided that, we're going to call this a zendo. We're going to call that up and that down. We're going to call, this body mine and you people, you. And these are the conventions of the world, and they're the consensus paradigm, which is formed by abstract thought. So it's looking into this more. What's that?
That's what we have dictionaries.
Dictionaries, yeah, help us do this, yeah. Yeah, the convention creates the dictionary. So, I thought as we did last time, we could just, you know, read a paragraph and then comment and question on it as we see it. And these are highlights I'm trying to keep the discipline of packing a chapter into a two pages. It's hard to do. It's been a long time cutting. So if you have, the book, of course, there's a lot more that's fleshed out here. But I thought, for me anyway, these pieces that struck me as highlights or summaries. So Jayla, why don't you read a paragraph? This is page 25.
Creating an abstract reality inevitably leads to resisting the reality that is occurring. That resistance is a struggle that many of us feel as stress, tension, unmet expectations, shame, guilt, disappointment, discouragement, frustration, impatience, desire, and fear. Desire, the ability to think ahead of where we are to fulfill a present need, and fear, the projection of what might happen onto the current situation, are both solidly placed in symbolic language. Both are born from thought, need a narrative further continuance, and are motivated by a deep sense of incompletion, the flaw of separation. In Buddhism, this is called the Noble Truth of Suffering, and comes from our learned ability to conceive our way out of danger. The brain has 1.5 million years of abstracting behind it. Why should it simply stop believing in the worlds it has created when thinking has been central to its survival from day one?
And I think that the author has, maybe it was in the first chapter even, how he mentioned there's very good reasons for this abstract thought for our survival. So it's not like we should just disparage that ability, amazing ability we have, but the way we've kind of reified and solidified that very functional thinking mind to create this strong sense of actual separation basically leads to our suffering. And I thought this was a very nice list of painful list of terms that I'd say these are different types of suffering, called stress, tension, unmet expectations, shame, guilt, disappointment, discouragement, frustration, impatience, desire, and fear. All I would say types of suffering, the first noble truth, or types of discontent. So it can come in many forms, right? As we know. And of course, this first noble truth is the teaching that let's get in touch with what all of these are based on, and so we can really unravel this discontent and be free in an ongoing way. It's the whole point of practice, right? And I also notice that he's emphasizing here fear and desire, particularly, which are types of suffering. But those two in particular are always based on the future, right? This abstraction of a imagined future is the cause for both fear of something bad that will happen or desire for something good that I want to happen. But both fear and desire are, as I would understand it, completely present. It's impossible to have fear and desire. I think we can have other types of discontent in the present, but when we're really present, I don't think that these two are possible, because fear is always about something coming. And I think we can have anxiety in the present, but fear is always future-based and desire is always future-based. Yes?
Well, I'm thinking now, and maybe fear isn't the right word, but like, let's say in the moment, if something painful is happening, or is imminent,
imminent sounds like in the next moment.
Well, okay, I mean, I can't think of what would an example be. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to apply your statement.
Mm-hmm.
That it's always for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering, could it ever be a present moment emotional reaction? Or would that then really not be fear? I'm just thinking of the adrenaline. Say you're driving the car, and the car crosses in front of you, and you slam on the brakes, and your body shoots with adrenaline. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that fear? Maybe that's not fear. Maybe that's adrenaline shooting through your body because you almost just died.
Yeah, I think. Yeah, I think I maybe wouldn't call it fear in that case.
Fear
at least
some rumination.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, and I don't know if you know if you're running from a leopard or something. I think that you could say there's a lot of anxiety and adrenaline in the present. But it's rightfully based on fear of the future implications of the situation. But, I mean, that's kind of extreme. But I think a nice way to think of these things is in Zazen, we could take all of these things as Zazen instructions too. If we're feeling fear in Zazen, meaning like sitting in the Zendo during a meditation period, then we can really come to see that actually, it's very rare that anything is truly threatening us in the period of Zazen. There might be a lot of things as soon as we leave the room, or even later in the period, like we might start fearing that, like, if I don't uncross my legs, they're going to break, or something bad will happen. Then we can see how we can separate the pain in the knee, the present pain in the knees that might be a painful experience of suffering from the fear about what might happen even worse if I don't move. Yeah. I just think a lot of suffering is based on future. And I think that's what, it's not all, but I think particularly fear and desire need and a kind of an abstraction of thought to create them. That's another point. Because, as we'll see later in the chapter, the very sense of future time is a conceptual abstraction. So let's continue.
Okay. This is the power that a thought has. It creates something out of nothing through its ability to recognize and remember. It makes the world and us within it unchangingly solid, because the words it uses to describe what it sees are static and fixed in memory. This influence of thought does not stop with the creation of an imaginative world consisting of concrete objects and a central solid object.
Solid subject.
Subject, yes. Concrete objects and a central solid subject. It also envisions a complete paradigm of separation, a sort of all-encompassing and total virtual reality in the same way a computer can simulate reality. Once the world is set up as isolated objects, a set of principles comes into existence that describes the mechanics of living in the world, the form and the formless.
So that's the title of the next section, Form and Formless. So I think, again, I appreciate this emphasis on the power of thought to make the world and us within it. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we just talk about all these kind of thought-constructed objects, but we're kind of not paying attention to ourselves. And sometimes we're emphasizing it's all about investigating the self and don't worry about the world out there. But how both this so-called external world and internal individual self, in what feels to be a separate body mind self, both of those are created by this abstract thought, conceptual thinking. The creation of an imaginative world consisting of concrete objects and a central solid subject, me. Yes.
Whose thought is it, or is, and I think I have the impression in the book he wants to say it's thought made in every moment.
Yes, yeah. And it's our thought, you know.
But
I mean,
I create her in this moment, so like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Your version of her.
Yeah.
Right. And we'd say, but this isn't just thought made, but the way we're perceiving it.
Yeah.
is our thought, is, because you could say it's not, you know, the way we call it, this is a nice example, because if we've done sesshin in the zendo here, we call this board, we call it the meal board. The meal board. Meal board, because when we eat meals in retreat here, we put our bowls, our eating bowls on this. So it's kind of like the kitchen table. It's kind of like our eating table is this board. So when we say, what is this? I immediately see it as a table for bowls, due to my thought. Because we have it, if we say, what is the name of this, for people who are in the sesshin world, we really have a name for this board called the meal board. But for people who haven't done these Orioki eating meals, they'd be like, what? You're calling that a meal board? Are we supposed to eat it or something? So in that way, you'd say we really see it as a different thing. You might see it as, it's just the way that this platform is constructed, and there's no real reason to have it this, I kind of have this wide board here. So but when you start using the bowls here, we start to see that, oh, there's a reason why it's a wide board there. And so in that way, it's constructed by our thought. You could say the direct perception of just the color and the texture and so on, those are not really abstract thought. But even then, we could say that they're the way the sense faculties construct things. So almost below thought, there's maybe even a subtler kind of construction. And the sense of ourself as, yeah, who am I? I might say, like, well, I am this body and the thoughts. I could say, well, what is this type of thought that kind of creates some kind of subject of experience that seems like the body is almost like the subject of experience and the thoughts and feelings that go with it. And we see how, oh, we just take that so for granted, right? But this is the investigation of, what is this? Why does it seem like this body and package of body and thoughts and feelings is like a subject or me, like an identity? We can see, oh, it's actually, as the book proceeds, we see thought is actually creating this perception of me as a body and mind, and the world as objects happening to the body and mind, and that's what we call separation. As soon as we have the thought-constructed me and a thought-constructed world, I am not the world, the world is not me, and then it's duality or separation. And we all perceive that way, and there's good reasons for perceiving that way, and yet, it's, for one thing, it's not really real. It's a kind of illusory perception, and although it has a lot of good functional purposes, it creates a lot of suffering. We could even say that all suffering is based on this misperception of separation between an apparent subject and an apparent world of objects. Yes?
Can you go over again the basic reason it seems like that's not the case, which is if I touch her, she doesn't feel it?
She doesn't feel it?
The other person.
She does, yeah. So if this is true, then why is it then that when I'm hungry, she's not hungry?
So there's ways that in the so-called consensus paradigm, where we seem to be like these separate beings, there's laws that kind of govern this world, this consensus world, which is why it's so convincing that it must be reality, because it's not random. It's not like a big kind of seething soup of randomness, right? Of course we know it's not like that at all.
Sometimes it
might feel that way. But usually it feels like that's a good example of like, this body is hungry and there's a perception of hunger here that person doesn't, they just ate and they don't feel the hunger there. So conventionally, or in this consensus reality, there's two different people, and we can distinguish between them, just like we can say there's a person here and there's an altar in the room over there. This doesn't all just blend into mush. And yet, we could say, even though the conventions function this way, the deeper reality, we could say, the ultimate truth, is that it's not really those. Even the feelings of one person feeling hunger and one not feeling hunger, those the true nature of those experiences is identical. Could say something like that. And this, I think this chapter will go further into this in this next section called the form and the formless. Actually, see if it gets into it more here. This last sentence that we read, once the world is set up as isolated objects, a set of principles comes into existence that describes the mechanics of living in that world. I hear a little bit of what you're asking is like this. Once we have this basic perception of a subject over here called me and a world out there called other, then there's a whole dictionary full of terms to describe this, and the mechanics of living in that world, all the principles about them come into existence. So I thought of what kind of principles come into existence. Things like saying, please pass me the salt. That's just like an ordinary thing, right? But that's completely based on this paradigm of like, me is this body and mind, you are over there, and there's this salt that's closer to you over there. So I'm asking you, a person that looks like me, so I can infer that you feel like you're you over there, and you're near the salt, so can you please pass me that salt? Thank you. You know, it's just normal activity, right? And that's like the whole world of assumptions, like that you can pass me the salt, and we know how to do that, and that's a reasonable request. And you know, nobody gets too offended by that. So it kind of works, especially if we use the word please. But that's why this is going underneath all of this and saying, seeing how, wow, for you, say, please you pass me the salt. When we go underneath this, into the with so-called formless, we see, wow, that doesn't make any sense anymore from this ultimate perspective to say, please pass the salt. But it works very well.
Why doesn't it make sense?
Well, because it's kind of assuming that, that me, is some sort of like fixed identity over here. It's convenient language, so in a way we could say it works, it functions. But then we assume this me that doesn't have the salt is a real entity, and it lacks salt, and it actually is a little bit uncomfortable because this food is not salty enough. So if you say like, no, I'm not going to pass you the salt, then I might feel like, I can't believe. You're not going to pass me the salt? How dare you? Yeah. And then, so just by the very convenient setup, we over-reify it, and then we get into like, they're not going to pass me the salt. And like, I really want salt, and I will not enjoy another day until I have some salt for this rice. You know? All the implications.
I think that was a good example because, even if there isn't any separation, it appears that there are differences.
Yes.
So, for example, I mean, I can move my body, right? But I can't move your body.
Yeah.
And I can't move the salt.
Yeah.
So, indeed, I need
that
request.
Yeah, that's, you could say that's the world of cause and effect, and it has these particular laws, and they function in particular ways, and we learn them from the get-go. And they get more and more complex, and the world of science investigates the laws of cause and effect even more intricately. We can say that's all the world of form, as he's going to talk here about form and the formless. This world of like particular things that interact with other things is the world of appearances, like as you said, I think the word appearance works very nicely, and we don't deny appearances. We live in the world of appearances, but because appearances cause so much suffering, when we start to believe that they're more than appearances, then that's why we have these kind of teachings. So even when we start deconstructing the appearances, it doesn't mean that we don't use the appearances. But appearance is a nice word because it's the world of appearances functions very nicely and we can function in it. But also the word appearance means that it's just appearance. It's a mere appearance that has these particular, and I think because the laws are so particular, like these ones we're bringing up, like, well, I can move my arm, but your arm doesn't go up. It's like, then it's really convincing, so convincing, the consensus paradigm that most people would never question it at all. And when we can see when we start to deconstruct it, that it doesn't deconstruct the appearances, it only just deconstructs the fixed, you know, essentializing, reifying of the appearances, which is what really causes the suffering. So, moving along into the next section here is called the form and the formless.
There's a familiar optical illusion that when viewed in one way is an old woman, and when viewed in another it becomes a young girl. What we see in the picture is dependent upon how we focus, and the perception of one excludes the perception of the other. Both perceptions are totally and completely available within the whole, but within each perception the field yields only the subject matter that is aligned with the way the brain is looking in that moment.
So the picture is in the book, if you have the book, but you've probably seen before that optical illusion. You know, is everyone familiar with this?
Yeah.
And can everybody see the two, the old woman and the young girl, right?
It always blows my mind.
Yeah. It took me a while to get this, actually. I could only see the old. Do y'all know this? Can anyone not see both of them? And can you see the old, kind of like this big nose and big chin and kind of baggy eye, right? And the so-called young woman is looking the other way, right? This is her chin. This is her chin instead of the nose. And this is her ear. Yeah, it's her ear instead of the eye, right? So I think it's neat that if you don't see it, usually most people end up seeing one first, and then it's really hard to see the other. But then when you see the other, then it's maybe hard to go back. But you get familiar, and pretty soon, the more you look at it, you can go back and forth, right? You can start shifting your perception once you've seen them both. It's a slightly different version, but it's here's another one. Can you see? What do you see in this one?
Native American.
Yeah, like an Eskimo, right? Yeah, with a fluffy thing. Yeah, like an Eskimo looking into a cave or a doorway, right?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
Yeah.
One is a profile.
Yeah.
One is a big profile, yeah. And then the nose becomes the elbow.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. The nose becomes the elbow, right? See. You can either see it as a face with hair up here, a nose, mouth, and hair, or you can see a whole standing Eskimo with, here's their feet and their head, looking the other way into a doorway, cave, yeah, with a fluffy head, hood. Yeah, can you see? And of course there's lots of optical illusions like this. Another classic one is two faces in a vase. And at this Science and Non-Duality conference, Patrick and I went to last week, I can't even remember who it was, but one of the speakers, I think a scientist, showed this optical illusion and said that this, when this, and I think it would be true of all of these when there's, it's like a double, two different images, right? And they did some brain studies, and they found that it's impossible to see both at the same time. It's you can get really used to seeing one or the other, but you like if you try to see them both simultaneously, you can switch really quickly once you get used to it. But I thought this was interesting in this study that they concluded that it's impossible for humans to see them simultaneously. And I think the reason for this is because it's two conceptual constructions. It's just conceptual, the way, you know, indirect perception of just color and shape. They're not even an image of a person at all, right? They're just color and shape. So the idea of seeing a person is a conceptual thought construction, and thought can't like take in these two different versions at the same time. And I think this is just a metaphor he's using to talk about the form, the two truths we sometimes say, like the form and the formless. And the old Indian metaphor for this optical illusion is in the dark you see a snake, right? And you're afraid of a snake and what it might do to you. And then you shine a flashlight, which is kind of like shining your wisdom on the snake, and you see it's just a rope. It's not a snake after all. It just, in the dark, it looks like a snake. So it's similar in that you're looking at the same thing, and the thing doesn't change at all. I think that's the important part of the metaphor, is that the objective world doesn't have to change, but our perception or our perspective has to change. And the nice thing about the snake and the rope metaphor is that the snake is this perception of something dangerous, and all this emotion comes up around this projection of snake. And when you see with the light of wisdom that it's just a rope, immediately the fear dissipates too. And we almost feel like silly. Oh, I'm so afraid. But like, there was nothing to be afraid of. So I think that metaphor has nice implications about the form and the formless too. And that is part of the, I have heard in Buddhist teachings about that usually for most sentient beings, we only see the conventional truth, which is like the person, you know, or the conceptual idea of how things usually appear. And to shift that perspective to see the ultimate, we can do that. Like even when we just sat silently, right, for a minute, as people reported, it's a little bit, our world is a little bit different. Even in 1 minute of sitting in the present, what does the world look like without the memory, right? It's already a different perspective. And so that when the Buddhist story is most people just see the conventional. On the Bodhisattva path, at some point, people can actually recognize the ultimate or the formless. But at the time they recognize it, they don't see the conventional. And the Buddha story is Bodhisattvas then get more and more skillful at switching back and forth between the conventional and the ultimate. And one story I've heard, I don't know if this is from sutras or a later idea, is that as the Bodhisattva path continues, they get more and more, it gets more and more easy to shift between the two views. Almost like very quickly can shift, but it still isn't simultaneous until Buddhahood. This is one story. And then a Buddha can see the two truths simultaneously, which humans can't with optical illusions, apparently. And they sometimes say, this is inconceivable. And I think it's something to question, because sometimes I think maybe we really can see them simultaneously. As we get, we can discuss this as we get further into this, because simultaneously might be that you still see the conventional, but you know what it is. Mm-hmm. So it's like, see, you're seeing the ultimate, but not as some like nothing. You're looking at the appearing world, but kind of like in a dream. So maybe possible to see the two truths at the same time in that way. So, questions before we go on?
Oh, this reminds me, someone said recently, I don't become liberated, but all things become liberated from me.
Ah.
I kind of like that.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and all things become liberated means like, you know, from their perspective, they were never bound in the first place, really. But we could say, from our perspective, all things become liberated through me. And that's, sometimes we talk that way, like in the self-fulfilling samadhi chant that we do. It's this description of all the rocks, tiles, and pebbles are radiating light to all the beings and liberating all beings in the lower realms, and they're all liberating the rocks, tiles, and pebbles. And this is Dogen speaking this way, and then he says, but all this doesn't appear within our usual perception. It's just the way it's actually working. Yes?
Speaking of non-duality, it seems like that's kind of what you're describing. I mean, that...
Maybe you could say non-duality is the non-separation or duality between these two truths, the form and the formless, which we'll get more into. Or we could also say non-duality. I think it's often talked about in spirituality as the non-duality between the perceiver and the perceived, or the subject and the object, mm-hmm. between me and you.
It seems like it's also, if you're talking about it, that there's form and the formless and formless.
That's in the form. Yeah.
It's not distinct. Like
that's right. Thing. That's right. Yeah. So that's why these. Well, in a way, the optical illusions. I think it's just a metaphor, and all metaphors are limited. But a nice thing about this metaphor too is that when you shift perspective, you're looking at the same thing.
Yeah.
Right. You're not like looking over there at something else. It's the same thing that you're looking at, but from two perspectives. And that you could say is non-duality. Mm-hmm. There's one reality, but it can be seen from two perspectives. Or two paradigms. The name of this book is Paradigm Shift of the Heart. Yeah. Did you have a question? Yeah.
Well, I don't know, something I was thinking of Rachel's question, why can't you experience one person, you know, if you touch one person, why the other person?
Mm-hmm.
It seems like sometimes I felt really, really still. Sometimes I felt like really, really deep, richly experience of somebody else. And then not only that, but sometimes there are traces of things that are otherwise maybe seemingly unknowable.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, if I knew Rachel exceptionally
mm-hmm.
well,
mm-hmm.
like I might know that she does something when she's really hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And then because I've had that experience myself, and because I know the nature of it, I might not precisely know exactly what she's experiencing, but like have a very, very vivid experience of maybe seemingly of what she's experiencing.
Yeah. You might even know that she always likes salt with her rice, so before she even says please pass the salt, you just pass it.
But it's more than like knowing what to do to make her happy. It's maybe
feeling
seemingly direct experience.
Yeah. That's what we call empathy.
Yes.
Empathy is actually like the ability to feel what another person feels. And we all have that to some extent. And through practice, I think we cultivate it more fully. And so that is a nice thing to bring up, is that you could say, we can't exactly experience exactly what another person is feeling, but that empathy, especially empathy that comes through being more and more present, and clear and relaxed, that ability seems to increase, I think is a hint at we're approaching opening to how we're really not separate. And that's a little clue. And not separate doesn't ever mean that we're like, when I raise this arm, your arm will raise or something, because it's still the laws of the consensus paradigm of dependent arising appearances function in this particular way. But as we open to the more and more deeply to the formless paradigm, the connections start to become more apparent. And even in the Buddhist world, an example of this in the tradition is these things like kind of psychic powers that was always part of Indian Buddhism, that being able to actually know other people's minds. It's just sort of like, it's never an important part of the tradition, but it's in the background of like, and they say it comes through, not through insight. And this is the Buddha story, is those abilities come through, not through a particular insight into emptiness or selflessness, but they come through samadhi or concentration, the power of concentration, getting really, really, really present and settled and non-conceptual to the point where these things are working in ways that they don't usually seem to work. Whether or not this is even true, it's a nice example of how we're not as separate as we appear.
Well, it's interesting about that. It seems to be engaging still in a conventional way, like that there is hunger. Even if I'm experiencing somebody else's, it seems like it's still engaging really deeply in the conventional
Yeah, that there is hunger in the first place and how that works. And yeah, those are the laws of cause and effect. And how those laws come to be and how they work. I mean, that's the world of science and all kinds of topics of studying form and so on. And so this spirituality is without neglecting that, it's also looking underneath that at the formless paradigm. Yes?
Sorry, I know you want to go on, but to me it seems like those rules of cause and effect, if I'm getting your metaphor right, or the fact that her arm is not raising right now, that's not delusion, though. Any more than seeing an Eskimo is delusion when another person is seeing a face.
Mm. Yeah, well,
it's just one side of the paradigm, but it's not just consensus reality and it's not delusion. It's reality, but there's also another reality.
Well, I think it depends how we use these words. So I think consensus reality doesn't have to be called delusion, for example, or something to get rid of. In fact, I think we can't. There is no human life, I would even say, without consensus reality. So I don't think we quite want to get rid of that. Although we could say the Buddha's parinirvana is like ending the story of human life. But while we're alive, let's enjoy fully this consensus paradigm called human life, and the way that it works and the particularities that it works, and delusion, like I was using the word illusion, it's somewhat illusory in the sense that I think illusion means something like things appearing in a way that their true reality is not, something like that. So it's still in that way, we could say that do we say that ultimate truth or the formless paradigm is more real? Within Buddhism, there's sometimes debate about this. Sometimes they say, in a way, it's called the ultimate truth. It sounds more real. And in a way, this is all abstract thought talking right now, right? We could say it's more real in the sense that it's reality is something that is always the case and, you know, can never change, for example. But another way we could say these two realities, the two truths or the two realities, are both they're both equally realities. And they're equally real. They're just two perspectives. That's a nice way. That's a more non-dual way of talking about it, actually, I think, is they're both equally valid and they're inseparable. So we can't ever say that one's better than the other. Well, as Nagarjuna says about these two truths, he says, without a foundation or understanding of the consensus conventional truth, the ultimate truth cannot be realized. But without realizing the ultimate truth, liberation from suffering cannot be had. So in that way, you could say, we really need the ultimate for liberation. But we need the conventional for the ultimate.
So somebody told Nagarjuna this metaphor of the snake and the rope, and he said, that's a good example, but I'd like to improve on it by giving you this example of this picture where both of them are equally real.
Yeah, the snake and the rope, that's true. The snake and the rope is slightly different in that the rope seems a little more real than the snake, right? There's another in the Indian Buddhist tradition, sometimes they take it to a third level and they say, after you see that it's a rope, if you look even closer at the rope, you start to see that it's just fibers woven together when you look really close up, and it's not really a rope, it's just a collection of fibers. So that would be another way to kind of say, well, even the rope isn't quite real. And then you say, well, are the fibers real? So like someone like Nagarjuna would say in the end that none of it is really real. This is all just conceptual construction all the way down.
And then it's time to just have tea.
Yes.
For me, what's most important about that is that the snake causes suffering.
Yes.
When I see the snake there, I'm like, oh.
Mm-hmm.
And it's similar to if I'm talking to somebody and they're, you know, saying something I don't like.
Yeah.
But really, if I can just see they're just talking, and like Thich Nhat Hanh says, it's just all suffering is a misunderstanding.
Mm-hmm.
What reality is.
Yeah.
That's the value.
Yeah, so I think that maybe the...
positive.
Yeah, whereas this maybe, it doesn't, we don't necessarily suffer so much with either version. So that's a nice part about the rope and the snake, yeah.
Because the other thing of the arm thing?
Yeah.
It seems to me that, the other thing of the arm thing is it seems to me that like, To say that because I can't make somebody's arm lift means that we actually are separate seems to deny the like profound and myriad ways, other ways that we are connected and we do affect each other. And it's also like, wouldn't say right now, like, I can't go lift a boulder outside, right? And that doesn't mean that I feel that me and the boulder are, that's an indication that me and the boulder are separate. It just means that like, that's just not something I can do. It's just not part of reality. And similarly, like, I can't move somebody's arm. It doesn't necessarily mean it's separate. It just means it's, like, not something that's actually necessarily possible.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good point. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. It doesn't mean that it's separate. In fact, we see that it's not actually separate, but that the laws in the dream world of appearance function in a particular way. Just like when we're dreaming, when we're asleep, again, it's not random. Like, you usually don't walk upside down or something in the dream. It seems like we're a person. Gravity's functioning in the dream.
You can fly in the dream.
Sometimes you can fly, but it's still you're flying in a kind of three-dimensional space. That's, you know, there's certain laws. But they're a little more flexible in the dream. Yeah.
Next paragraph.
Next.
The world of form, objects, and the formless, awareness, the formless stillness, wordless seeing, presence, or that which holds all objects, are partially analogous to this illusion. Words create independent objects that are no longer tied to any sense of unity by literally placing them outside the whole. The sense of being a person is a remnant of abstract language and limits what we are to only what can be described by words. When we look at the world through the perceptions of a person, we see the world of objects, and that is all we will see. The person of form can only see objects of form because the eyes are trained to look at shape and color or the objective reality. It is not that the formless is unavailable, but that our brains are wired to see only from the form perspective.
Let's keep going.
Okay.
Most of us have spent our lives living within the field of form, and it garners our attention because there is a great deal that we still want from objects. Not only do objects give us a sense of purpose and meaning, but also defining the objects we see enables our sense of self-definition. The clearer we define the objects of our perception, the clearer we are defined as a person seeing those objects. Objects reflect back their history and importance in our life and reconfirm our place in an object-filled world. And this internal monitoring keeps us within the formed and objective view of reality.
When our perceptions are fixed within form, we see only half of the optical illusion. Waiting in the wings is formless awareness, which is not an object. It may sound obvious that we can only navigate in this world when we objectify what we see, but what is astonishing is how invested we are in the objects and how little we notice the seeing. We usually take the seeing for granted, thinking that it is just what eyes do. But formless awareness does not come from the eyes or the brain or the person and pre-exists all forms.
Yeah.
Whoa.
so form...
The activity.
What's that?
Let's do the activity.
Let's do the activity, yeah. So as you can see here, I think it's a nice point that it's astonishing in how invested we are in the objects and how little we notice the seeing. And it's just, you might say it's astonishing, but in a way it's not that astonishing because objects are like, as he says, we're wired to relate to objects. And objects is all, you know, sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, and thoughts and feelings also. And any experience is an object. And so we're used to relating to experiences, but we hardly ever notice the experiencing of them, which is like the formless awareness that holds them, because it's not an object. So, and this, as where it's in parentheses here, it's often from a footnote in the book where he defines the term. So I think this came from formless. I think this is the footnote. Formless, he's defining as awareness, actually. Sometimes we say formless is just emptiness. You can't say anything about it. But in Buddhism, we talk about these turnings of Dharma wheel. The first turning of the Dharma wheel is like, you could say formless or emptiness is just no independent self. And in the second turning of the Dharma wheel, it's like everything is empty or formless. And in the third turning of the Dharma wheel, it's awareness is the formlessness. Formless, it's a knowing emptiness. It's an empty knowing. There's a kind of a cognitive aware quality called Buddha nature. So this is kind of a third turning understanding of formless. So here's the exercise.
An easy way to differentiate form and formless awareness is that form is what you see, the objects of sight. Formless awareness is what sees the objects, the seeing itself. To get a sense of this, try asking, what is seeing in this moment? Not what is being seen. With this question, there may arise a felt sensation of awareness that is the seeing. The sense of a person forms around the seeing as a specific object within the seeing. But awareness is not dependent upon this person for seeing.
Can you follow this? The first part is maybe a little bit easier, yeah? Differentiating between form and formless awareness. Form is what you see, as we're saying, all the objects of, in this case, sight, but also the sounds that you hear and the sensations that you feel in the body. And formless is awareness. Formless awareness is what sees the objects, the seeing or the hearing. So, at least conceptually, we can probably get an understanding of the difference now between objects and that which is knowing the objects. Yeah.
Yes. To really meditate on that question,
yeah.
What is seeing in this moment?
Yes.
That's not a quick little intellectual
no.
thing. That's like really...
It could be quick, but it's not intellectual.
Yeah, so to actually feel it, mm-hmm. I would have to sit with it.
Let's do that.
Challenge myself.
Yeah, yeah. But to clarify, before we spend at least a minute on this, do we see where we're going here? We're looking for what is seeing in this moment. And in this moment, I think, is a good one, because that keeps it from being an abstract idea. We're talking about right now, what is it that is seeing? What is the experiencing that we call seeing? Not what is being seen. So it's a stepping back from the object to the knowing of the object. So in Zen we call this turning the light of awareness around and shining it back. We're, the awareness that's directed constantly towards objects, we're looking back at the source of the knowing of the objects. And I think that the hardest part, generally, I think, for people to do this is we're so used to looking at objects that when we're looking for the seeing, we're looking for the seeing as another object. Because we're so wired to relate to objects, especially if there's an instruction. Now, okay, we're looking at things now. Now let's look at the seeing of things. Okay, where's the seeing? We're looking forward to something. But it's not a thing, right? It's not an object. So I think another way to talk about this instruction of turning the light around, it's more like just relaxing into the present, really. Because if we're directing the attention towards some object, or trying to find an object, we're going to just keep looking in the same way, even if it's back there or somewhere else. It's more like we're just opening to the space of knowing. So I like to use the words for awareness. I think awareness is a great word. Also knowing. So like, what is the awareness of the room right now? What is the knowing of the room? Also the word experiencing, I think, works nicely. We're having an experience called this room. It includes sounds and sights. What is it that's the experiencing of the room? Or not what is it that, but like be kind of open to the experiencing of this experience. And then the last part of this paragraph is a little bit tricky. There may arise this felt sense of awareness that is the seeing. And then this little like kind of note about this, the sense of a person forms around the seeing as a specific object within the seeing, but awareness is not dependent on this person for seeing. And maybe the reason he's saying that that was a little bit hard sentence, I think. When we look for what is it that's seeing now, sometimes we say, it's me, and we contract into like, the person is the seeing. And he's saying, no, it's not the person. We don't need a person, actually, for seeing. And we might say, yes, we do, but that's conceptual. If we're just stay in the direct knowing and just try to be the knowing as distinguished from the known objects. Yeah.
But isn't this sort of going dangerously into the direction of there's some kind of spirit?
Well, I don't know, whatever we
because
call
how
it.
How could it not be? I mean, how could it not be the sense of a person? It's got all my sensory apparatus.
Yeah. So that's why I think those earlier sections were nice, because they talked about how we project outwardly, we project the world, and we project inwardly also this, we conceptualize a sense of a person and sense organs and thoughts and so on. So without doing conceptualizing, and we could say these are objects out there, but also our thoughts and feelings are objects of awareness. This is why it's, I think, kind of a neat thing. So we say it's not like the thoughts and the feelings are the subject. The thoughts and the feelings are just more objects, but we call them inside. And the inside and outside are somewhat arbitrary. So this awareness is like aware of colors and sounds, but it's also aware of feelings and thoughts and emotions. Does that make sense? So the awareness is not inside or outside. It has no, edges or boundaries, and yet, of course, it's here, right now. Yes, Gabby.
So one of my critiques of this book is that I feel like, and maybe this goes back to the, what we're trying to get at in terms of how sensation is recognized in other beings apart from us,
mm-hmm.
and saying subject versus object, mm-hmm. which the author delineates so forcibly, like it's subject and see everything as object, that I think there's like, and that's a very Western predisposition to say that, that the world is in terms of subject and object. Lots of cultures actually think of the world in terms of multiple subjectivities. So for me, that was an obstacle. It's like, well, how do we get beyond? So if we can say, okay, there's multiple awarenesses and maybe multiple subjectivities, that's what I'm stuck on. It's like, how do we get beyond even not just object versus subject, recognizing that maybe, yes, everything has subjectivity. How then do we get beyond this concept of multiple subjectivities to get to an even more like unified
mm-hmm.
Sense of experience?
Yeah, I think that's where this is going, and I don't know exactly how he'll talk about it as the later chapters unfold, but I would say exactly right, that subjectivity and objectivity are both projections, or we could say expressions of this one awareness. The awareness, I think this is an important point, that the awareness we're speaking of is not subjectivity. That subjectivity is actual, from the point of view of awareness, subjectivity is another object.
Right.
Of awareness.
Right.
And the awareness can't be distinct. You can't say there's 20 awarenesses in the room. If we start going more deeply into this, and I don't know if he'll talk this way, but that if we're saying that we might say there's 20 different subjective consciousnesses or subjective experiences, but the experiencing of them, we can't say that there's a whole bunch of different ones, because it is more this unity realm.
Right. So for me, it was like, how do you even, so beyond this kind of claiming that there's a world of objects and subjects,
mm-hmm.
that I think...
Well, he's pointing out that's the illusion without, you know...
But even that framework is very, I feel like, very partial.
Well, and I think he's calling that framework is the consensus paradigm,
mm-hmm.
right? The consensus paradigm is a world of subjects and objects that are separate. And that's the whole, this paradigm shift is we're trying to shift out of that paradigm of subjects and objects. And I think you're right that it's maybe a Western paradigm even more strongly, and maybe other cultures have different ones. And we're saying that all of this is what we're trying to actually see through.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? He's not kind of defending the subject-object.
No, thing. Right. I guess I was just trying to figure out like where this positioning of like the self versus the other, and these ideas that we're talking about in terms of empathy, and like we recognize that in certain circumstances we can associate with the other, and so there is that recognition of subjectivity.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I think I was stuck on his kind of consistent, like, yeah, I'm not sure how to.
It's kind of hard to talk about some of this stuff too. I mean. But we might say from the point of view of this formless awareness, that is like actually like unified, boundless awareness with no separation. And that's the realm where there's like complete, you could say empathy is naturally between different beings is naturally there from this perspective of the big awareness, because when we see that, as a separate being, we see that if that's our true nature, the formless awareness, then there really isn't any separation between what I call me and what I call you. So the formless awareness is going to be the unifying new paradigm that's that all compassion and benefit comes out of, because all sense of separation is really just appearances from the point of view of the boundless awareness. But this, again, we're just on the second chapter.
He's building his case.
He's building a case, yes.
It's the idea then that this awareness exists, it's there, we just aren't plugged into it.
Yeah, we could say that it depends what we mean by exists. I think the root of the word, English word exists means, like, exist means to stand out from something. So it's usually when we say something exists, it means that thing stands out on its own, apart from other things, as its own thing. So in that way, awareness doesn't stand out from anything else because it is everything. It is the complete totality we'll come to see. But in the bigger sense of exists as, it's real, we might even say it is the only true complete reality, and it includes everything. This awareness we'll come to see. And you could say it exists, but we're not in touch with it or something. But I think also, as we'll come to see, that we are, it's actually what's happening right now. It is this awareness. It's not hidden actually at all. It's just that our focus is on the objects. So we're overlooking the knowing of them, which is, I think, this particular exercise that, if we have time, what we can do is the pivotal exercise of the whole book, in fact. It's distinguishing and really getting in touch with the awareness that's present right now, a very simple, ordinary awareness, but to notice that it's here and to distinguish it, at least to start with, distinguish it from the objects of awareness. And then those can be collapsed into one unity and later. But now we're making a distinction. Yes.
So, if that was awareness, if there are absolutely no sentient beings on Earth, would it exist?
Well, we as sentient beings wouldn't know that it exists, right? So it's kind of speculative. It's kind of a thing. It's the kind of question that sentient beings can ask. But I feel like the more we get in touch with what it is, and how it is ever-present, and how it's not even bound necessarily, by exploring it more and more deeply over time, how it doesn't even seem to be reliant on our perception of it. For example, maybe little clues are like, when we're asleep, one could say that this awareness is continuing, and so it doesn't depend. In a way, we cease to be a sentient being while we're asleep. In a way, we have, our senses are not operating while we're asleep. But we could say the awareness is still alive and awake, because otherwise, why would we ever wake up again? There's various ways we could think about this.
Why would we have dreams while we're asleep?
Yeah, and why would we have dreams while we're asleep? Seems like if any experience, like a dream is an experience, then every experience that I would propose is an expression of this awareness. So it's a bigger kind of question, but it may not depend on sentient beings. But it wouldn't be known in the way that we can know it. We're doing this exercise as sentient beings. Let's know our own nature of as this awareness. That's a unique thing that we can do. Yeah.
I was sort of investigating verbs as opposed to nouns, things versus doing, or actually there's a flow to all verbs. Mm-hmm. But then I noticed that two words, one word, we are beings, being. The noun and the verb, we are beings, just being, open.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the verb, I think, works well in...
And that would... Beings is the form version, and being is the form
version. Yeah, which is similar to the world of objects, is we could call experiences, which is nouns, and we're used to this world of nouns, and we're now trying to be the experiencing of them, which is not a noun, and since it's not a noun, we can't find it as an object.
Yeah.
Objects are nouns,
and
it's a
our perception of the object may not change, but moment to moment,
we could say the types of experiences change. But we could also say that this experiencing or knowing, in a way, itself doesn't ever change, but the expressions of it,
yes.
They change. So let's Do we have can we tap in a little bit? It's about time to stop, so we have a minute. We can try it for a minute. It's a nice conclusion. So we're, another way that and just another hint for how to do this is just asking, is awareness present right now? Is awareness present right now? So we're so used to like asking about objects and things. So this just by asking, is awareness present, and trying to answer experientially, don't try to like come up with a conceptual answer, but in your presence right now, is awareness present? Of course, we could do this for longer, and you're welcome to do it in Zazen for the rest of the week. this is the practice I like to do in Zazen. Yeah. And you can see very.
It felt just like Zazen.
It
felt great, actually.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I don't know what you would have to say, but I noticed one strong tendency I think comes up, especially if just getting used to this, is such a strong tendency to look for it as another object. Maybe a kind of subtle object, but like, oh yeah, I got it, awareness like this. Even the slightly conceptual idea of it's like space or something, it's still slightly constructing it, slightly objectifying it. It's so hard not to objectify it. And yet, it's totally unhidden at the same time. It's ever apparent. This is it. It's totally ordinary. Any questions about distinguishing the knowing from the known?
It's also not space, right?
Yeah, it's also not space. It has a...
We look at that and it's not either. It's our awareness mixing almost.
Yeah, it's mixing with the things.
Yeah.
It's not like the things don't go away. One more little, I think, nuance of this that I find helpful is, and you can take this up for the week, is usually we could say our, some of you have heard this before, I know, and excuse me, but... see if this is helpful, that usually our experience is like we're focused on the objects of experience as the dominant like foreground, and awareness is always present, but it's in the background, means like we're not focused on it. So it's shifting this ratio of we're like bringing the awareness into the foreground, and the objects are still here, they don't have to disappear, but they're like we're paying less attention to them, they're a little bit more in the background. That makes sense. We're shifting the foreground-background ratio. So it doesn't mean when we're... You can do this with your eyes wide open. In fact, this is the best. We get more used to... It maybe does help at first to close your eyes, because that's once the sense of objectification is so strong with the eyes open. But eventually, you can have your eyes open and just be like, there's the knowing of all of this color and shape and room that we're in. And I have a sense of it, and it's not a color and shape. It has no color and shape, but it's aware of all the color and shape. And at the same time, there's the color and shape. But if you suddenly say, like, what does that say over there? Then I don't think, then it recedes to the background, because we're focused on a particular. Yes?
You're using the word knowing, and I'm having a little trouble with that because it seems like a lot of this is about not knowing. I mean, it's like
So this kind of knowing,
really know.
This is a knowing that we call knowing without touching things, as one of our ancestors says. It's a knowing that has no object. It's just knowing itself, not knowing information. It's not a conceptual knowing. So I think we can just, we didn't finish this chapter, so we can maybe continue with this, but we can see if we start the next one too. There's no rush to get through anything. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.